Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
I don't know if you've noticed, John, there seems to be some animosity between the genders.
What?
What's going on there?
Did I miss that story?
It's a surprise.
It's a trending right now on Twitter.
I mean, this is the story of men and women throughout all of human history, so this isn't a surprise. But I do think it's important that we always talk about it so that we're recognizing what's happening in culture, what the conversations are that are going on all around us.
Are you talking hashtag Me Too?
I'm talking hashtag Me Too, but I think it's not just that. I think that the hashtag Me Too movement opened up conversations about gender relationships in the church that were long buried. Mm-hmm. I think that the church is actually... I think the church owes a debt of gratitude to society for bringing up an issue that we in the church have had a hard time talking about. I think that the issues of gender and the issues of female submission and male leadership, the power dynamic that exists, not just in homes that would be that perhaps they would call themselves complementarian, which means that people believe that men have specific gender roles and women have specific gender roles, become even more marked in churches that are complementarian, where men have specific gender roles and women have specific gender roles.
Well, this has been historically traditional.
It has been. But there's a larger conversation that goes on amongst people of goodwill who are trying to work it out. And there is a conversation that goes on between people who are just angry and hacked off and express themselves badly, either verbally or in altercations online. And Right. We're seeing that all over the place.
Whether it's in or outside of the church.
Right, right. So I think it's important to talk about the actual differences in how we look at gender roles. And then I do think it's important to talk about the attitude with which we have the conversations.
Outstanding. Jerry Boyer is with us. Jerry is editor of Town Hall Finance, here to talk to us about that topic exactly, especially from the perspective of Genesis 1:3. Hey, Jerry, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing, John?
Good. Always good to have you with us. Thanks.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah. So, Jerry, this is fraught with angst already.
Minefields.
Right. People feel very strongly about how men should act and how women should act. And so we see a conflict in culture, but also a conflict within the church.
Yeah, we do. And I think that avoiding the topics don't decrease the tension. They increase the tension.
Right.
Because the influence of the Bible is over the long run to bring peace. I mean, Jesus said, I came to bring a sword, because as biblical ideas get introduced into a society, they run counter to the, you know, to the pagan culture. But over time, wisdom produces peace. So I would say that the church has maybe abandoned its role as a teacher in this zone, left the world to figure it out on its own. The world has defaulted to the world's mode, which is combat. And that makes this now a toxic conversation, which then Christians are afraid to have because it's a toxic conversation. But our unwillingness to have this conversation is what made it toxic in the first place. And there's no solution other than the Bible. So we better get on with it, even if it hurts a little.
Right. So the role of gender is so important to God that he essentially placed it first chapter of the Bible.
He did, and it's so important that he only says the creation is very good after you have male and female. Mm-hmm. So we have God progressively creating the world, making it's good, but, okay, day one it's good, but if it's good, why do we have day two? Well, because you can make it better. And there's this whole thing, I don't want to get into a super detailed read on this. I spent 5 years on this and wrote a 240-page thesis. Okay, so we're not going to be able to handle all that. So some things are just going to have to take as, hey, Jerry isn't winging it. He really thought this through. So there's a lot of good and not good and very good stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is everything is good in the creation. The Bible says everything is good except two things. One, the creation of the firmament is not declared good. Nothing is said whether it's good or not. It's this: the firmament separates heaven and earth. And I would argue that it's not declared good because it's temporary. that there's not supposed to be a separation of heaven and earth forever. It's for now. And so it's not declared bad, but it's also not declared good. And then all the other actions of creation are declared good. And then the first time that God says something is not good, it's about Adam without having a wife, without a woman. This situation is not good. And after she's created, then after everything's done, then God says that everything's mo tov, very good. So this gender thing is not like some side thing. This is at the very heart of creation. I mean, it's not just a human thing, really. It's a thing of reality itself. Heaven is the place where the bridegroom lives, and earth is the place where the bride is. You know, heaven and earth are to some degree a representative or a kind of a foreshadowing of male and female, which is coming. God is our husband. Christ is the bridegroom. We're the bride. There's a marriage of heaven and earth. And so we see that early in creation, and then we see the creation of the woman. And there's a lot going on there. Let me just say, I don't know how much people are ready for in this, right? Because we don't think biblically. We think, like, already people are starting to say, so whose side is he on?
Right.
Right?
What category can I put him in?
Right, exactly. And who is he on, the man's side or is he on the woman's side, right, in this fight? And it's like, no, like, you're completely missing it. What's declared not good? Is the man declared not good? Uh-uh. Is the woman declared not good? Uh-uh. What's not good? The separation between them. The lack of love and relationship and camaraderie between them is what's declared not good. The Bible does not take sides between man and woman. The Bible takes sides against the people who would take sides between man and woman. The Bible does not come down on the patriarch side. The Bible does not come down on the feminist side. The enemy acts by dividing the man and the woman. God says it's not good for the man and woman to be divided. That's literally the Hebrew. It's not saying it's not good for the man to be alone. It's actually divided. And the first thing the serpent comes along and does is try to divide them. When we play man off against woman, whether we're taking the allegedly conservative patriarchal view or the more liberal feminist view, whatever those things are, when we are playing them off against one another, whichever side we're taking, we're doing the enemy's work. Mm-hmm. He plays them off against one another.
Mm-hmm.
He manipulates them. He triangulates in modern terms. He triangulates between the man and the woman in the garden.
Mm-hmm. So recognizing that the enemy is the enemy's first goal is to make there an issue between man and woman should help us as we wade into whatever the conversation is, no matter what our perspective.
Yeah, we got to start out understanding gender from the Bible point of view, and we can't order our ideologies off the rack. You know, we have to, there's a tailor-made biblical view, and we got to kind of go back. You know, in the Reformation had this idea of ad fontes, back to the sources. We got to go back to the sources and recreate the biblical understanding mm-hmm. of man and woman instead of scouring the Bible looking for ammunition in a fight that is really largely a fight between two pagan views, even if one of those pagan views pretends to be Christian. Mm. Patriarchy is a pagan view. I'm not saying complementarianism is a pagan view. I'm a complementarian. But complementarian is not male chauvinist. Complementarian is there's a difference, and they have different roles, and tends to place on the man the obligation of chivalry, not the obligation of throwing the woman under the bus. And historically, the church has tended to take the view that the woman is the temptress, the woman causes the fall, she seduces Adam into the fall, and therefore you got to be careful about women, because women are the way that the devil gets to men. And that is absolutely not what's happening in Genesis 1 through 3.
Okay, so this is interesting, because that perspective that the woman is the temptress and the woman is where the problem is going to come from is not unique to Christianity. I mean, this is why women across the Arab world are wearing the hijab.
Yeah, and it's not even part of Christianity. It's a pagan import into Christianity. What happens is early on in the early Christian church, you had a lot of church fathers. They're great men. Some of them are martyrs, but they didn't read Hebrew. So they're using the Greek Old Testament or they're using the Latin Old Testament, and they miss some things. And so they start to pull pagan philosophy in. So here's a pagan philosophy, Stoicism. So Stoicism basically says that you're supposed to be rational. Men are rational. Women are emotional. Rational is better, therefore men are better, therefore women should not be heard from, Which is a completely different question than whether women should be pastors. I'm going to leave all that stuff aside, because once I say anything about that, then half the group stops listening, right? Yeah, and I'm not even going to say which half. And so this pagan idea of Stoicism identifies sexuality and emotion with women, non-sexuality, the life of the mind, and rationality with men, and therefore it takes the side of men over women. That's not what's going on in Genesis. I mean, In Genesis, both are to blame, but the man is more to blame. The first failure is not the woman eating from the fruit. The first failure is Adam. He's the one who drops the ball first.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because that is not a common reading. Certainly if you asked, you know, I would say 100 people who were familiar with Genesis, they wouldn't say that. 100 of them wouldn't say that.
Eve was at fault.
Well, yeah, that's a shame, because it's pretty clear in the text, and it's especially clear in the Hebrew text.
Okay, so where are you reading from, Jerry?
I'm going to jump around. If you want, I can go with individual. I can open up my Hebrew and go individual, but probably that's going to kind of, you know, slow us down. So what I'll do is make sure I'm going to publish a paper on this, and I'll send it to you so people can see the detail. But Adam's job, the job that Adam is given, is to shamar, that is to guard the garden. Mm-hmm. Right. He's there to shamar and avode the garden. So he's there to guard and to serve in the garden. Well, what's the most valuable thing in the garden? What's the most important thing in the garden?
Eve.
Well, yeah, the woman.
Right.
Nothing more important. So he's to guard her. What's he to guard her from? Well,
evil.
We can make different arguments. Evil. Right. Exactly. I would say he's even there to guard her from anything that doesn't belong in the garden. And the serpent doesn't belong in the garden. The serpent, the Bible tells us, is a creature of the field, a hayatzadi. So it's a creature of the field. It doesn't belong in the garden. There are things that belong in the garden, and there are things that don't belong in the garden. And whether you agree with me that basically certain animals are allowed in the garden and certain aren't, if you want me to say more, I can. Or you want to say, at the very least, he should keep evil out of the garden. He didn't. The serpent, an unclean beast who doesn't belong in the garden, who's there to destroy, comes into the garden, deceives the woman while Adam is standing there. Adam is present during this entire thing. It's made clear at the end of Genesis 3 that he's Minhi. He's with her the whole time that this serpent is lying and subverting and triangulating. He's there doing nothing. Mm-hmm. The first command God ever gave to Adam was to guard the garden, and that's the first failure. He doesn't guard the garden, and then he allows someone to come in. She's deceived, meaning she's not committing a high-handed sin. She's tricked. So he exposes her to that trickery, and that's the first failure. So this is mainly a failure of Adam. She fails, but it's much less a failure of hers than it is of his, because he's responsible. You can't be a complementarian and make her mainly responsible. I mean, if you're a conservative evangelical and you say men and women are different and men are leadership role or whatever, okay, there it is. It's a leadership role, which he fails in. So the idea of different roles within the gender, in this case, puts the guarding responsibility on Adam. She's not created yet when that command is given to him. She's created after. It's his particular role to be the shamar, the guardian of the garden, and he fails in it.
Jerry, for listeners who are just joining us, we're talking about the first three chapters of Genesis. And I mentioned that if you asked 100 people who had read Genesis 1 through 3, whose fault it was that sin entered the world, I think you'd probably have, people would say the serpent. But I think if you said, yes, was it Adam's or Eve's fault, I think probably 100 out of those 100 people would say it's Eve's fault. Now, your perspective is different. You're saying that an actual reading of those first three chapters indicates that Adam's role was to guard the garden.
He was not vigilant.
He was not vigilant in that. So therefore, the serpent entered. And when Eve was being tempted and succumbed, he was present?
Yes, the text clearly says that. I mean, first of all, the idea that he was there to guard the garden is there in Genesis 2:15, that he is to, you know, old translations say keep it, but that's what keeping something is. It's guarding it. The Hebrew is shamar. It means guard. How do I know that it means guard? Well, one chapter later, when Adam fails in the role, God puts a cherub there with a flaming sword to what?
Guard it.
Guard it. Same word, shamar. right? So, I mean, he's not there to be a farmer. The cherub is not there to be a farmer. So it's the same idea. And that's why it uses the same Hebrew word. So he's there to guard it. Now, if you ask average Christians, absolutely, that's what they'd say. But there's a whole world of scholarship, even conservative evangelical scholarship, over the past 40 years that understands that the garden is like the temple, and Adam is like a priest, mm-hmm. and that priests guarded the temple, and they didn't let unclean beasts in. So none of this stuff is original with me. It just, I don't think it's sort of gotten to, you know, down to the people in the pew. What the people in the pew get is either pagan patriarchy pretending to be Christianity or pagan feminism depending to be some kind of radical progressive form of Christianity. They're both ideologies which are imposed on the Bible. So what you see is that Adam is told to guard the garden. He doesn't guard the garden. He is with her. How do we know? Because at the end of Genesis 3, we're told. I mean, it's really interesting the way Genesis 3 goes. You have this whole long conversation going on between the serpent and the woman. And the Hebrew here is Isha, right? Isha can mean woman or bride or wife. I argue at great length that it should be translated wife here. And the reason is, if you look at the end of Genesis 2, what does it say? And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Okay? So his wife there is Isha, right? The word Isha is translated as wife. Now, ignore the chapter divisions. The chapter divisions aren't there in the original. Right. This flows right into it. And the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed. Now, the serpent was more crafty than the beast of the field, which the Lord God had made. And he said to the what? One verse earlier, the Bible always translates Isha as wife. In this verse, it translates Isha as woman. And then throughout the rest of Genesis 3, mysteriously, the verse is translated as woman. See, I think if you treat Genesis 2 and Genesis 3 as a unity, you see that the man and his wife are both naked and were not ashamed. And then now we have the zoom in on the wife. And if you translate it as wife, which the Hebrew word definitely can be used as, then what you keep asking over and over again to us, the account, the woman said to the serpent, from the tree of the garden, we may not eat or touch it. And the serpent says to the woman this, and the woman says that. All that time, if you saw that Isha means wife, and it was just said that she's his wife, what are you asking yourself? Where's the husband? If I'm telling you a story and I said, this happened to my wife and that happened to my wife and this happened to my wife, you'd say, well, where were you, man?
Right, right.
And at the very end of the story, we find that she took and gave to Adam, who was with her. The whole time he's with her listening in, not doing his commanded shamar function.
Right. So, Jerry, even with all that, and it's an excellent reading, there are many people who would say, even in the 21st century, well, clearly, women are not worthy to be in the pulpit. Women should not preach. She should not teach. I mean, in Genesis 3:16, it says, your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you.
Well, that's part of the curse. So I'm not sure we ought to be. I'm not going to speak to whether women can be in the pulpit because I've made a commitment myself. Anything where someone has a Four Views book, go read that. You don't need me taking positions on it, okay? So I'm going to speak on issues where I've done a great deal of detailed research and can speak in detailed way in defense of what I'm saying. And I'm not going to take positions on meaning and mode of baptism, predestination or not, premillennial, postmillennial, women ordination, or all those things. Because the moment I do that, I start alienating people and I can't get through with stuff which I know is true. You know, at least I have strong reason to believe that it's true because I've checked it out myself. So I'm not going to say whether women can be in the pulpit or not. What I am going to say is that that's part of the curse. That's not an endorsement. That is, God is not saying you should have an urging for him. You should, your desire, your teshuka should be for him, but he will mashal or rule over you, and that's the way it should be. He's describing
what
the
is.
Curse.
Yeah.
He's describing what is, just like he talks about sweat of your brow. Now, I could look at the thing that says you'll eat by the sweat of your brow and say, therefore, the Bible forbids air conditioning, but that would be silly. This is a fruit of the fall, and we are, part of redemption is to roll back to the degree that we should the fruit of the fall. Now, some people argue that you shouldn't give, you know, women pain meds in the birth process because God says, you know, that you'll toil and bring children into the world. I don't that's just a silly misunderstanding of the Bible. All of these things which are listed are things that are coming from disobedience. They're not things that God is imposing. There's only one active verb that God uses here, as I recall, which is, I will put enmity between you, between the woman and the serpent. That's active. He does not say, from now on, I want you women to long for men, and I want you men to rule over women. That's right. Not what the verse says. That's what we hear when we read it, because people have drummed that into us. But if you carefully read the text, even in English, and certainly in Hebrew, that's not what comes through.
Right. So, Jerry, wait, define enmity, please.
Define what?
Enmity.
Enmity.
Warfare, bad will, a lack of goodwill towards one another, conflict. So there's warfare or disagreement or alienation come between the woman and the serpent, and also between the man and the woman. I mean, what happens? It's really interesting. God comes into the garden, and it says that the man and the woman hid themselves. And then God says, Adam, you know, where are you? And what does Adam say? We hid ourselves. Nope. I hid myself. There's no solidarity between them anymore. By the way, that's the first appearance of the first person singular pronoun. The first I in the Bible is Adam. Anoki, I hid myself. Now, in English translations, you'll see I earlier, because sometimes the verb is a first person verb. But the actual word I does not appear in the Bible before that. Mm-hmm. He's not equating his account as being merged with his wife's. When there's not a we anymore. You know, it says they put on these loincloths. They girded themselves with loincloth. Hagarot, strong overtones of military garb. A hagar. They're putting on warrior clothes. They're at war with one another. They put on warrior clothes, and when God comes into the garden, they hide separately. They're not together. They're not in solidarity with one another. Mm-hmm. You see, in marriages, when people start saying he starts to count his stuff and she starts to count her stuff, that's Genesis 3 stuff. You know, that's I hid myself. They weren't together in it anymore. There was enmity between the man and the woman.
We're misreading what you're telling us. After all this time, we are misreading Genesis 1 through 3. Now,
saying that it was Eve's fault,
right,
that sin entered the world.
So
she screwed up.
Why are we misreading that? And if we see your correction to this by shining a new light on it, what would it mean for the sexes?
Yeah, I'm not sure that we're all misreading it. I mean, there are places in the history of the church where I think people understood this, but I think there's been a strong tendency to misread it. And I think that starts very early in the church. And I think it starts with the church adopting a pagan philosophical worldview, the one I talked about before, Stoicism. So Stoicism is a form of Platonism. Mind is good, matter is bad. Thinking is good, sex is bad. Rationality is good, emotion is bad. Men are rational, women are irrational, right? That's brought into the church.
Right.
The Bible doesn't teach that at all. I mean, it's quite to the contrary. In fact, one of the founders of Stoicism actually gives an example of, he speaks negatively about Judaism, right? He criticizes Judaism. So what am I, a Jew or a Stoic? You know, he had anti-Semitic views because he recognized that Judaism was not in line with his philosophy. Stoicism and Judaism were enemy religious views, but the early church basically kind of throws out its Hebrew roots, adopts Stoicism, and then we need the woman to be the patsy. She's the fall guy, as it were. So she's the first sinner. She's the first failure, and therefore women carry that burden throughout the rest of the history. I mean, there are people in the Reformation who got this right. But this, not everybody gets this wrong. But I would say that my tribe, which is conservative evangelicals, have tended to get this wrong. And there's a controversy going on right now. I'm not going to mention names because then it's personalities. I'll mention one of the names, a positive. You know, there's a woman Bible teacher named Beth Moore, and she's been criticized by some conservative, you know, Bible teachers. And one of them made a statement, you know, that she should go home. And then he clarified, and what he said is, well, the problem is that Eve got herself out from under Adam's authority. She wriggled out from under his oversight, and she was deceived. And then Adam couldn't live without her. She was in his heart, so he followed after her. Man, that's pretty convenient. You know, I mean, she's the Jezebel who rebels against Adam. And what's Adam's fault? He just loves too much, right? I mean, his only fault is that he loves too much. I'm sorry, no. If he loved enough, he would have killed the serpent, or died trying when the serpent was poisoning his wife. So I that got in there somehow, but it's definitely not the biblical view. I'm looking at the verses right now. There's nowhere it says that she originated the sin. He's clearly given the job of guarding, and it's clearly said that he's with her. And the Bible clearly says that she was deceived, meaning who's the greater sinner, the one who's deceived or the one who's not deceived? The greater sinner is the one who's not deceived. If I know what's going on and I don't do anything about it, and you don't know what's going on, who's more at fault? Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm more at fault. I mean, with the more knowledge, the more responsibility. If somebody lies to you and you believe them, maybe you're gullible, but that's not as bad as being fully aware of what's happening and then, you know, sinning anyway, despite the fact that you're aware that it's a sin.
So what causes those of us who believe in Jesus, who believe in the Bible, who read it, to fall into this pattern? Whether I think some people would say it's just a pattern of, you know, 1950s Americana. You're saying it's a much more ancient pattern of Stoicism. What causes us to be susceptible to that?
I think what causes us to be susceptible, a couple of things. One, it's really hard to put aside all the arguments you've ever had in your head or all the arguments people have ever heard and actually carefully read the text. It's a very difficult
thing to
do. It is hard.
It is. I find that very difficult myself.
To just start over and say, God, I want to know. I
mean, blank slate.
My wife and I spent 6.5 years, really, 5 years studying and 1.5 years writing, and we didn't even know it was going to be anything. We just wanted to know what God thought. So we read through the Hebrew text over and over and over again and just kept stopping to pray, say, God, well, what are you saying here? Now, we did the research. We looked at the language research. I read the rabbis. I read the church fathers. I read the reformers. I mean, we did all the hard work of it. But in the end, it was, God, what are you actually saying here? And what people normally do is they read the Bible with what they've been taught in mind, which tends to be sermons, or you read it for ammunition in a fight. Mm-hmm. And be honest, how many pastors keep up with their biblical Hebrew? I mean, now seminaries tend to say you have to take Greek or Hebrew, mm-hmm. not both. That's pretty common. Most seem to choose Greek because it's a lot easier. And then even the ones who take Hebrew, you know, after a year or two, it's gone. So this is hard work, and you got to want to do it. And, you know, there's not a lot of glory in it. I mean, I don't think I could I don't know if I could publish a book or not. I just wanted to know. Throughout the history of the church, other people have wanted to know. And these conclusions are not new with me, but they're kind of forgotten,
right?
Because the big fight takes up all the oxygen in the room. The yelling, the gender war basically makes it so we can't hear the still small voice of God speaking in Scripture.
Right. So then does this go all back to, in some ways, you know, the hashtag Me Too? If men would show up, be responsible, tell the truth, work hard, do the right thing, none of this would matter.
I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I'm not saying that only men are responsible, but I am saying, as a complementarian, not a chauvinist, because they're not the same thing,
yes.
As a complementarian, I see the primary responsibility being the man. See, Paul says, look, the man was created first and then the woman. And then the kind of the patriarch or, you know, the chauvinist say, see, man's first, he's better. That's not what's going on. He's first. So the responsibility starts with him. So what's his responsibility? Well, he's to guard. He's to avode, which is worship and serve. And he's also supposed to teach, because the command she didn't exist when the command was given not to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So he's got to teach that to her. And when you read Genesis 3 carefully, you see that it was not taught properly, because she misquotes it. She says we're not to eat of it, mm-hmm. nor to touch it. So she got the verse wrong. Maybe he didn't teach it right. Maybe she changed it. And she also, just a subtle little thing, but she turns down the grammatical force a little bit. When God says, don't eat of it, because the day you eat of it, mote the mote, dying you shall die. You shall surely die. It's like a doubling, really strong. And she just says, we'll die. So she didn't get the importance of it. whether he failed to teach or whether she failed to learn, I don't know. The rabbis tend to say he failed to teach. See, that the Hebraic tradition puts a little more responsibility on Adam, maybe because they read Hebrew. But who failed there, I'm not exactly sure, but I do know it was his job to keep evil out of the garden, and he failed in that.
Jerry, I want to ask you about, you know, the link between New Testament perspective on men and women and what we see in the creation account. Because, you know, a classic reading of Paul's view of men and women is that it's linked to the creation account. And so if we want to understand what Paul means, we're going to look back at creation and we're going to realize that Eve was the one who sinned first. And so we're going to see that that's why women need to be silent in church.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's a problem because, as Peter said, Paul's hard to understand. So I wouldn't start with Paul. I'd read the Bible in order. You know, I'd read Genesis first and then understand Paul in light of Genesis because Paul's writing a commentary on Genesis. And by the way, I don't know why we skip over Jesus because, the account in Genesis is pointing us to Jesus. Adam failed. He didn't guard the garden. There's an angel put there. And then what? The woman is renamed. It's not Adam and Eve in the garden. It's man and woman, Ish and Isha, husband and wife. Then she's renamed Eva, the living community. She's given a new name. Why? Because she needs a new husband. Not really her husband, it's her son. But salvation is going to come through the seed of the woman. So that account is called the Proto-Evangelium, if you like the Latin, right? That there's a promise given that the serpent's going to be defeated, his head is going to be crushed by somebody who doesn't fail in a garden. We've got somebody who's in a garden who says, not my will, but thine. And so he embraces, he fights the serpent and dies trying. So he embraces the original Adamic role, and where Adam fails, he succeeds. Where Adam and the woman stole fruit from the tree, he's put on a tree. He's the fruit put on the tree as a restitution. He's in a garden, and they come for him. The soldiers come for him in a garden, and he gets up, and what does he do? He says, like, hides. While the serpent people capture his disciples. No, he stands in front of his bride, his disciples, and says, "I'm the one you're looking for." He does it so loudly and vehemently that a couple of the soldiers actually get surprised and fall over. So he undoes. This is a redo of Adam, and now he does it right. So let's go from Genesis to the Gospels, then to Paul. Mm-hmm. And then I think we understand, we can kind of go to that Paul is. And maybe understand things better.
And the flow from there. Jerry, you and Susan, both very deep, unique thinkers. As people listen to this hour and they want to engage with you further, what can they do? Where can they go?
Well, I mean, you're mentioning Town Hall, but I don't put this sort of stuff on Town Hall.
No.
I'm writing a long paper for Theopolis Institute on this, but it's not up yet. Basically just reach out on social media. You know, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, I'm on all those things. Bowyer.
Very nice.
Boyer.
Always a pleasure, Jerry. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. God bless.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.